I have...
Meeting at 1 o'clock?
I have...
We're going to get started. We're going to call a joint committee on the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee and the Public Safety Finance Division to order. Today we have a report presentation from the Working Group on Controlled Substance Laws, and first is Thomas Hertler. Please come to the table and state your name for the record. We don't yet have a quorum, and so I will officially call it to order as soon as we get a quorum.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Tom Hertler, P-E-R-T-L-E-R, I'm the Carlton County Attorney. Also chaired this working group. I have the privilege of doing that.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you again for your time, and I would like to, as you can see, everybody have the packet of material. You should have received the material. There's a full extended version of the report to the legislature, and then we also prepared a brief executive summary. I understand that this afternoon our time is somewhat limited, so what I will attempt to do is go through this as briefly as I can, perhaps referencing the executive summary, because that just tends to be a little bit easier for your review. And if there are some questions or comments that come up along the way, there is a whole host of materials that we have included in the appendices attached to the report. And there's a lot of information there for you folks to digest if you have, as you work through this process in the session this year.
I'm going to interrupt you for just 1 second. Members, on page 4 is the executive summary. Go ahead. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first thing I'd like to point out is that when we first convened, we had the 8 meetings commencing in August. Last August, 22nd, was our first one. And the thing that I would like to impress upon you folks in the committee is that there was a substantial amount of information, presentation, testimony that was taken at the beginning of the session that would bring some of the folks up to speed that were not as well versed in their particular area. The group itself, I have to commend the group. They did a good job, and they brought to the group a vast wealth of knowledge in their respective professions, expertise, as well as people that they knew whom would be beneficial to us. So in that regard, the folks that were there had a lot of input themselves. So we took presentations and information and a lot of testimony. Likewise, I would like to thank and let all of you know that you have wonderful staff. Staff did a great job. We were impressed. They were very helpful and it got us through this process as efficiently as we can. So that was beneficial. We had Judge Gomez, who retired in the process. So Ann Wall assisted with some of our research and bed impact. She's going to speak to you folks right after me. So if you have questions regarding the bed impact, Ms. Wall can take care of that for you. One of the things that, as we worked through this process, and we had at times a broad spectrum of opinions. We had a lot of people that were, it was close. We had a lot of close votes when we were making our recommendations. At last session, there were directives, 6 mandatory areas that the legislature wanted us to report on, and a whole host of other optional areas that we could take a look at. One item I would like to mention so everybody's aware of it, that when we're talking about controlled substances, and the working group was well aware of this, there are a whole host of what we commonly refer to as collateral consequences. We didn't tackle, there was just not enough time, and we didn't feel it was our position to get into sort of a collateral consequence agenda, because we had a lot of work cut out for us with those 6 mandatory reporting criteria. Okay. So we did that. We spent most of our time in those areas. And some of the other optional ones, they came up and they were interwoven throughout the process. But we have for you the recommendations we came to.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt you again. We will formally call the meeting to order. Go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. The first item on the extended, on the full draft version, is one item that everybody in the working group could agree on. And that was a recommendation that whatever comes out of the group would be, of course, attempt to have any local fiscal impact contingent upon adequate state funding. Of course, you know, when we're talking about money, there's always impact and there may be some local. But the group was unanimous in wanting the legislature to realize that. So that was one of the recommendations we made right out of the chute. The other one that comes out at the executive summary on the first page is the modification of threshold amounts. This, as you might imagine, was an area where we spent a great deal of time, and there was a lot of discussion and a lot of give and take that went on with respect to the threshold modification. We have included for you in your materials a final chart that shows what the recommendations were for the final suggestion. There is also in the table of contents some other charts that will show you initial proposals by 3 different groups. Kind of within our working group, there were 3 proposals that were put forth. And believe it or not, we actually had some disagreement on what we were going to call those proposals, but in any event, there are three proposals. So those are laid out for you at the appendix as well. Ultimately, what we made a recommendation to the legislature was that you can see, as you look at the chart, there was some increase in the powder, what we refer to as kind of the big three, meth, coke, and heroin. And the chart will indicate the suggested increase in weight. Now, by doing that, increasing the threshold amount of the weights of those big three controlled substances, necessarily that's going to change some of the people, their charges. In other words, someone who may have been a first-degree controlled substance will now be a second degree, maybe a third. That will have some impact, and Ms. Wall can describe for you what some of that impact would be when we're talking about bed impact and DOC ramifications. That was, like I said, one of the last items that we voted on, very close, one vote different. But one of the other thresholds that we suggested was the adoption of a marijuana grow provision. Marijuana grow provisions, you'll see that in your chart as well, marijuana grow proposal. And presently, there is not a marijuana grow prosecution. What we do as prosecutors, we prosecute individuals by the weight of the marijuana. So if the person has a certain amount of marijuana, it would fit into the thresholds of the existing weight classification for marijuana grow. There was much discussion, and we had a lot of friends from around the region and around the state in law enforcement and others that have indicated, even right here in Hennepin County, Mike Freeman can describe for you some of the real concerns that people are seeing in the community with respect to growing marijuana for profit. And when you're talking about for-profit, you're talking about other problems associated with that conduct. People assaulting and even committing murders. Mr. Freeman has an unfortunate stat that he shared with us that discloses and spells the rumor that marijuana is not in and of itself a nasty drug. So we did suggest a marijuana grow proposal. Likewise, there was a modification to the marijuana weight. Now, you should have in your packet some conversion metrics to pounds, and you'll see that presently, before any changes to the marijuana possession guidelines, it would take 100 kilos to get a person up to a first-degree controlled substance prosecution. That's 220 pounds. We're talking bail, you know, lots and lots of marijuana. So we've suggested cutting those weights down fairly substantially. First degree, 25 kilos. Second degree, 12 and a half. Third degree, 1 kilo. Fifth degree, still 42 and a half grams. What that means is about an ounce and a half. 42.5 grams is about an ounce and a half of marijuana. About that much in a sandwich Ziploc baggie would be about an ounce and a half. And there was also a recommendation that originated from law enforcement. It was a little bit surprising, but right now what we have is we go from a petty misdemeanor up to a felony amount, depending upon that threshold of 42.5 grams. And that didn't seem right to a lot of folks, to just have somebody walking down the street with a sandwich baggie of marijuana in their pocket, and it's a petty misdemeanor, not even a crime. It's like a parking ticket. You go pay the parking ticket. Well, if you had one more gram, all of a sudden it's a felony. So it jumps right from parking tickets to felony. And that didn't seem right. So what we had suggested was adopting a threshold 14 grams over that would be misdemeanor amount of marijuana up to the 42 and a half grams that is presently the threshold for the felony amount of marijuana. So that would incorporate something less severe than a felony, but not just a petty misdemeanor. So that was the recommendation as well with respect to thresholds. And that was a lot of the time. If you take a look on page 2 of the executive summary, we suggested no separate sentencing grid. And you're all familiar with the sentencing guidelines, and a lot of people did a lot of hard work in coming up with sentencing guidelines. We now have the CRIMSEC sentencing guidelines. The group did not think we needed a third sentencing guideline to take care of and incorporate controlled substance offenses. What suggestions we make, we feel comfortable that you can incorporate those changes with the threshold amounts into the existing guidelines grid, so we don't suggest tinkering with the guidelines grid, incorporating the grid we have, which in our opinion should work just fine with respect to the controlled substance offenses. The next item, a recommendation there on the second page of the executive summary, talks about additional aggravating factors. This was a topic that came up when we were discussing the concept of a kingpin violator. For a fair amount of time, we discussed the prospect of having a kingpin violator, the really bad drug dealer that is out there profiting from other people working and pushing the drugs for him or her. And the problem is, as we went through this process and we got close to our deadline here in January, as we worked with the sentencing guidelines folks and we looked at the actual numbers, it appeared to us that it would have too significant of a bed impact. In other words, we would be going the wrong direction, increasing prison bed space instead of going the other direction. So when we talked about additional factors, those kind of fell by the wayside because we decided we weren't going to try to attempt to tackle this kingpin violator. Likewise, the next one down, maintaining current criminal history score calculations. That's kind of hand-in-hand with the sentencing guidelines. If we're not doing anything with the sentencing guidelines, we're comfortable with the way people's scores are calculated presently for their history, crim history, that any people with prior crim history points would be incorporated into their present controlled substance offense, and that would be fitting into the guidelines depending upon where they fall in the grid. The fourth one down on that page is discussing the 152.18. You do have a copy in your materials of the actual statute. Some of you may be familiar with it. And there was a fair amount, I would say a fair amount of discussion. There was a push to have 152.18 modified so that the language would read it would be a presumptive sentence for those people that would be otherwise qualified for that type of a sentence, rather than a permissive sentence. And we did go around quite a bit in this regard. There were some comments that came up about the judges still having the ability, if we made it presumptive, to come up with some criteria to support their decision not to grant a 152.18 disposition. The problem, of course, that some of us felt is that it's rife with what factors should we come up with. I mean, literally, you would have to come up with factors that you tell the judges, here's what you may or may not consider in determining whether or not you are going to give this individual, this violator, a 152.18 disposition. That would be problematic, and we had some judges on our working group. It's always good to have some judges on the working group, and I think that it was fair for us to say that many times judges don't necessarily care for mandatory sentences and being told by statute, here's what we have to do. So that was kind of a general rule of thumb that came into play when we determined, as you look at the law as it exists now, it's not just the county attorneys or the prosecutors who are determining whether or not a person would be eligible for that sort of a disposition. It also rests within the sound discretion of the court. So you have two layers. You have the county attorney, you have the judge. So you have two layers of discretion, and those between the two of them, at least I can tell you my practice, I've been prosecuting drug cases in my office for about 12 years. I do all the drug cases. I'm not going around just picking up people and not giving them a 152.18 disposition. I'm a reasonable person, and most of my brethren in the County Attorneys Association are reasonable, and of course a judge's middle name is reasonable. So anytime you throw a judge into the mix, you've got reason upon reason. So we were of the opinion that we should leave the 152.18 disposition as it is now, and that was ultimately the recommendation. Tight votes, I'll tell you that, and there was a lot of discussion, but that was the recommendation for all you folks. Then we had, again, this area, the last one you'll see here, increased early release for the nonviolent drug offenders. You'll see that we made specific recommendations for the expanded use of that program. Now, Mr. Christ is here. He was at the Senate last week, and he will be speaking to you. There is some concern about the expanded use of the conditional release. And the comments that I and others have had is that it was a legislative mandate a few years back to start this program. DOC didn't suggest it, or they were the ones that were doing it because they were told to do it. They would prefer the use of their boot camp up at Willow, I think it is, and they would like to use that more and not so much the CRT. But once having been directed, this program's in existence, we believed that if we were to make better more assistance and expanded use of the CRP program, it would free up dead space, and it would allow for some money, savings money, that we suggested put half of it back into the DOC, let them hire more CD counselors, let the dead space be evaluated up to its capacity, and have the other half of the money, the savings, go back to the local communities, probation, people that are keeping track of these people after they get out in early release. And so that was an idea we had that, as long as we have the program, let's go ahead and see if we can make it even used better, and at the same time try to make that program effective and efficient. And we're confident, of course, that DOC can certainly do that if the legislature would like them to make expanded use of that. Of course, Mr. Chris will have more comments for you, but that, I just want you to know the working group was I believe, unanimous in the regard that we all thought it was a good idea, as long as we have it, to keep going and see if we can make better use of that program. So those in a nutshell, I know we have very little time, but that in a nutshell is the recommendations we made that we were directed to tackle. We did the best we could. It was spirited, and we have a report for you, and we certainly would be willing to answer any questions you have or comments you may have with respect to our recommendations for you.
Questions from members? Representative Bingham. Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I'd like to say thank you to our staff and also all the members of the working group for the time that you all put into this. I have a few questions. You answered a couple of them, but regarding the early release portion, was there any discussion regarding what would happen if there was a reoffense, being that this was kind of a, I'm sorry, Representative Eastland, you're in my line of think, sorry. was there any discussion along the lines of what happens if there's a reoffense, then if this kind of good time had been offered, and if they reoffended, was there any discussion about that? As we know, a big part of reentry is the out of the Department of Corrections treatment, the out of custody treatment. Was there any discussion about that?
Mr. Fertler.
Madam Chair, Representative. Yes, in fact, because the program itself is still relatively new, the numbers aren't that great, but Mr. Chris had indicated, at least at present, we haven't had a problem with recidivism, to speak, but it's so young, that some of these folks, there may be a couple, would get in trouble again, but at least at present, things seem to be working pretty well, and the actual numbers, we didn't have the actual numbers, because like I say, it was just kind of early on in the process.
Okay. Representative Bingham? Sorry, I just have one or two more questions. I'm sure that I'll be quiet. The other question I had was on page 14, something that was very intriguing to me, was the line that you talked, that is mentioned about halfway down the page, and it follows the number one. It says, use chemical dependency assessment at intake rather than the underlying drug offense to determine whether the offender is suffering from an addiction. Can you clarify that a little bit?
Mr. Fertler.
Madam Chair, where are you? About the middle.
It's on 14, and it's about halfway through. I guess I don't know if it was just the language that twisted me around a little bit, but are you saying that at the intake of when they're first, instead of going through the whole case process and then determining as a part of their sentence the assessment, and or are you saying that as soon if they are charged, they go right through the assessment to see if they get the treatment?
Mr. Bertler.
Madam Chair, Representative, at intake would refer to when, after they've been sentenced, they're going into the DOC system.
Okay.
Of course, prior to that, and prior to getting sentenced, there's a PSI that probation does, but after that, they come into DOC. At the intake, DOC would do that analysis to determine whether or not they would be a good candidate.
Okay, that's what I was wondering. And then the last one, and maybe this will be addressed at the end of the committee hearing, but what is the status of the working group now? Are you officially disbanded, or is that remain to be seen based on any decision that the legislature makes?
Mr. Bertler.
Madam Chair, you folks tell me.
Okay.
I'm here at your beck and call. If you have any additional work that needs to be done throughout the session, I'm certainly able to do that, but I believe that we were supposed to report the 16th and got our report done January 16th.
The only reason, Bingham, sorry, I keep going back on my word to you, Madam Chair, this isn't a good sign. but the reason why I bring that up is because the one consistent message I guess I got out of the report was that we didn't have enough time to insert letters, you know, like whatever it was throughout the whole report. So I just thought that maybe if there's a little bit more time, you could go back and focus in on some of the things that it sounded like the working group wanted to discuss, but just didn't have time because of the tight deadline. So that's the last thing I'll say.
Representative Johnson.
I'll pass, Madam Chair.
All right. Further questions from members? All right. Seeing none, next on the agenda is Ann Wall, Senior Research Analyst with Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Wall, and I'm a Senior Research Analyst for the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. And we prepared the bed impacts for all the various proposals and the final bed impact. So that was our role with the working group. I believe that you have a Shepherd handout, but it's also in the report on page 76, what I'm going to talk about. It says, it's titled Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission Proposed Modifications by the Working Group, Estimated Prison Bed Impact. Okay. The working group is doing two different things. They are recommending an increase in the thresholds for marijuana, for cocaine, methamphetamine, and heroin possession offense, first degree possession offenses, and also an increase in the thresholds for second degree sale increases, a modest increase. If you look at page 2 of the document, you can see there what the changes are. First-degree possession offenses, the current threshold is 25 grams. They're recommending that it be increased to 35 grams. Second-degree possession goes from 6 grams to 10 grams, and second-degree sale goes from 3 grams to 5 grams. Third-degree possession stays the same as far as the bottom threshold goes. And we determined that about, depending on the various severity levels, around 30% of the offenders would basically move down a severity level on the grid as a result of these proposed changes to the thresholds. If you go back to page 1 and we look at the top box there, the cocaine, meth, heroin box, these threshold changes we estimate would result in a prison bed savings of 126 beds. In order to do these estimates, we had to make two assumptions. One, that the people sentenced in the future will look like the people that were sentenced in the past. We based this, our estimates on offender sentence, our data on offender sentence in calendar year 2007 was the basis for these estimates. So if there's any change in drug offenders profiles or the number of drug offenders in the future, these estimates probably would not be hold true.
If I could ask, is the total bed savings per year?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Okay, eventually. You know, it staggers in over time, but eventually it'll get to that amount over a year. The other assumption we had to do was based on the amounts, the weights of the drugs involved in the individual crimes. We had information on a limited number of crimes. We sent out requests to county attorney's offices to get the weights for more of the offenses, and we ended up doing pretty good. I think we had over 70% of the possession offenses and 50% of the sale offenses. So, but then what we did is we extrapolated from those weights and said for the offenses we don't have the weights for, we assumed that they look like the offenses that we do have the weights for. So we moved a similar portion of offenses around on the grid. The second component of the threshold changes is actually to lower the threshold for the marijuana offenses. And I believe the second to last chart on the on this document, threshold and case information under B, thresholds for possession and sale of marijuana, will show you how they're changing. First degree sale is going from 50 kilograms down to 12.5. First degree possession from 100 kilograms down to 25, and then similar along the line. Again, back to the first case, the second box of marijuana offenses, we estimate that these marijuana threshold changes will result in an increase of 29 beds. So the total result, when you take the reduction in beds for the cocaine, meth, and heroin, and the increase in beds for the marijuana, comes out to 97 prison beds saved. And then that would be, some of them would happen the first year, because there are a few people that would no longer get prison sentences, so you would feel the impact from those beds immediately. The cocaine, meth, heroin proposal would shift 19 people who are currently on going to prison, they would shift to probation. The marijuana proposal would shift 8 people from probation to prison, so there would be a total of 11 people shifting from prison to probation, and those beds would be felt immediately. And then, depending on the length of offender sentence, this is the impact from the other impacts would take place in the second or third year, but the total impact should be felt by the end of the third year. That was all I was going to say. There's more detail on this chart that you can look at as far as, you know, what numbers of cases move where on the grid, but is there any other questions? I'd answer them at this time.
Question from members. All right, seeing none. Thank you very much. Next is Mike Freeman, Hennepin County Attorney. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Mike Freeman. I'm the duly elected Hennepin County Attorney, and it's nice to be back in the legislature. Thank you very much. Madam Chair and members, time is of an essence, so let me get right to the point. Representative Bingham, the answer to your question is about the expiration of the working group having been trained by Senator Dean Merriam to read statutes precisely. It says that our terms expire as a commission upon submission of our report. So I would interpret that as the conclusion of your hearing today would turn into a pumpkin and we'll be done. But I do think that the members of the commission would be interested in assisting the legislature if additional assistance is desired. Just, Madam Chair and members, the legislature has struggled with thresholds on drugs for a long time. We were even struggling when I was here back in the 80s. And the thresholds for crack and powder cocaine were set at different amounts. A challenge was taken to the Minnesota Supreme Court, and it was said that it was a denial of equal protection to have different thresholds. The legislature did a very predictable thing. They reduced the threshold of powder cocaine down to the level of crack cocaine, and that's how we got the initial threshold. This legislature and previous ones have struggled. Do we have the right amount? Are we sending the right people to prison? Many of us feel that those who have an addiction problem and either possess or smell or sell small amounts of a drug are doing it to feed their habit, and we have some empathy for them. Those who sell large amounts suffer from a disease called greed. And I'm not familiar with a treatment program that can resolve greed other than putting them in prison. And that's the struggle we've made, where to draw that line. I believe our threshold commission was put together to assist you in trying to take data and information from lots of different people and to come up with the right line. Underlying that was the acknowledgement that if we could save some beds in prisons, we would be doing a good thing. And as our budget gets worse, that's probably even more an imperative than it was when we started. But backed up on all this is public safety, and how far can we push? Members, let me refer you to the report and be specific. You heard a number of us. On page 8 of your document is the cocaine, meth, heroin chart. You see in the far left the severity level, and next over is the present amount of 25 grams of possession. Law enforcement suggested increasing it by 10 grams, over 40% to 35. Who is law enforcement? Of this working group, there were 2 prosecutors, Mr. Pertler and myself, 3 law enforcement, Jim Craich from Benson, Minnesota, the chief of police there, Lieutenant Dave McLaughlin from Stearns County and drug enforcement, and Paul Allen, who is a narc in St. Paul. And we met about 14 times over the summer and early fall to try to come together with increases in powder and crack and meth, an amount to make sure that only people who were going to prison were those who get into the greed classification and not others. But always at our back was, what does public safety demand and what could we do? And so the original proposal from law enforcement would increase the possession amounts for first-degree possession and for second-degree possession. The meetings with the overall group ended up in a compromise, as should be done, and we also ended up in a result of an increase in second-degree sale from 3 to 5 grams. We believe these amounts will help to ensure that very few people who are merely addicts will end up in prison. I will say to you that it was interesting for me to learn with presentations from DOC and others that the number of people in prison declined in 2008 over 2007, and the number of drug offenders declined in prison. DOC tells us, and when we went back and looked at the people, frankly, in Hennepin County, we're sending to prison, and I will acknowledge, Mr. Mullery, that the Hennepin County has about 25% of the population and about 50% of the serious crime. That's what comes with being a large metropolitan area, and a lot of drug crime, to be honest with you. We work hard at it, but we have a large amount of drug crime. When you look at the numbers of people who are presently in prison today, or the new ones that are going in, there are very few non-violent drug offenders. You see people who are either large sales people who ought to go to prison, or we see diversions. We see 15218 you heard about. And we also hear, as Mr. Chris will testify, about the alcohol and drug treatment programs that are part of the Projects Incarceration, better known as Boot Camp, as well as the CRP program. I think our working group found that this, between DOC and other diversion programs, we do a lot better job of keeping nonviolent, low-level drug offenders out of prison. Members, I think that the cocaine, meth, and heroin chart on page 8 reflects a good compromise that will to ensure that very few nonviolent drug addicts get to prison, but that public safety will still permit us to do our job, not only in the Twin Cities, but in greater Minnesota. Police Chief Craig talked at great length and very eloquently about the impact of smaller amounts of drugs in the town of Benson. Members, on page 6 is the marijuana growth proposal chart. Our county attorney certainly indicated to you we simply didn't have a marijuana grow. The problem is, in South Minneapolis, somebody buys a house, they fix their basement up with lots of water and a lot of electricity and grow a lot of marijuana. And if we bust them early, the plants are so small, the weight is so low, we can't do much with them. If we have a marijuana grow, it requires, for you all who are gardeners, a root ball, and a plant coming up. And so then we can do it by number of plants. The temptation, and I've heard police officers say to me, listen, Mike, we know where this is going. We know the plants are too small. Give us another 3 or 4 weeks, then we can bust them and put them away a long period of time. I don't like that idea. I think what we ought to do is be able to take them down when we find them. This marijuana growth proposal will do that. Finding members, I would say to you, the marijuana threshold chart, as Chair Pertler indicated, we need to get realistic on this. There's no reason, even a city boy like me knows a little bit about bales of hay. I would just put to you that you have to have 4 bales of marijuana hay to get a first degree possession under present law. That's too much. And so I think we reduce those to levels that make some sense. Madam Chair, members, no working group and no legislative process is perfect. I think there's some good compromises in here. This is a bill that has addressed the issues that you asked us to address. It's a bill that's defensible in terms of public policy and public safety, and it's also a thing that's good politics. We're going to make sure that those folks who shouldn't go to prison don't go and have opportunities. For those people whose addiction who are in prison have a chance to get the treatment, that will shorten their prison sentence. That will be good for them, and that will be good for us, not only in money, but you know, almost all these drug people will get out of prison, and we're going to see them again. And if we can get them some treatment there, and some meaningful treatment, it'll help us out in the streets. Madam Chair, I'll be glad to stand for questions.
Questions from members. Representative Cornyn.
Madam Chair, Mr. Freeman, the question on the people that were letting off a little easier, the people with the low amounts, do we have to worry about, into the present system or the system we have with severe penalties, we can maybe scare them straight or keep people from trying it? and by lowering the amounts do we have, are we passing a problem off to human services? I mean, more addiction. In other words, do we keep so many people from doing it now? Do we risk by this? For sure, we're keeping people out of prison. We're saving money in prison beds, but we're turning over a problem that's eventually going to end up in addiction, because now, with no penalties to worry about for a small amount, they keep using, and then go to a chemical dependency. Or do we have that worry?
Madam Chair, Representative Cornish, you know, nobody knows perfectly where to draw these lines. If we do, we'd be making a lot more money than we are. I would point to what this legislature has done on methamphetamine as answers to problems like this. Meth was a terrible problem. It's diminished greatly because of two things occurred. This legislature, number one, made it harder to get because you can't buy over-the-counter like you used to be able to some of the components. And secondly, we did a superb educational campaign. There today is still a billboard on 280. And it shows a woman who's really quite attractive and just like a neighbor down the street looking great. And 9 months later is a picture taken after she's been on meth, and she looks horrible. Teeth have fallen out, eyes are shrunken, hair has fallen out, wrinkles are there. That kind of campaign done billboards by the County Attorneys Association at the State Fair made a real difference. In my view, these lower level drug offenders, really the way we're going to be able to do this is to educate them that this stuff isn't any good for you, have some penalties, and have some meaningful treatment. That's really where we go with the low-level folks. And as I said before, Representative Cornish, I don't have an answer other than incarceration for those who live in greed.
Further questions from members? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next is John Stewart from the State Public Defender. Thank you. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is John Stewart. I'm the State Public Defender. I was here 2 weeks ago to hear the overview from the Department of Corrections, and I heard them say that they're projecting growth now in the prison population of 200 beds a year. So if you think in terms of the size of the prison in St. Cloud, that was built for 800 people. So right now we're on a path to need a new prison the size of St. Cloud every 4 years. I was aware of this projection and of this likelihood before I started working on this working group that's under discussion today. And so I was hoping that we would have consensus on some proposals that would make some good-sized alternatives, particularly for people who have relatively small amounts. And I should say we had lots of debates. We had lots of votes. Most of the votes were 8-8 or 8-7. There was just a continual debate between people that wanted to have alternatives and people that felt pretty strongly that we should be very cautious about making changes. So I'm here to spend a few minutes mentioning three things that we didn't do in this task force. First of all, you've heard about 15218. 15218 and a report from the State Court Administrator's Office is Appendix D in the report. 15218 provides that people who are first offenders for possession crimes for the two lowest levels of drug offenses, fourth and fifth degree, can plead guilty and be put on probation, and if they do everything the judge tells them, then they won't have a conviction. That's what 15218 is. And our experience in the courts and the State Court Administrator's Office says that this provision is used very, very inconsistently around the state. Some counties have tremendous resources for dealing with low-level possession drug offenders. For instance, Hennepin County has a diversion program, and it uses 15218 extensively, and it also has a drug court. But the majority of counties don't have a drug court, they don't have a diversion program, and they use 15218 very occasionally or sporadically. So the suggestion was to make this a presumption. That's one of the measures that was defeated in the recommending working group here on an 8-8 vote. I would just want to say, without getting into the question that's come up, the county attorneys say that the Supreme Court study is wrong. Without getting into the study, the substance of it is, if somebody gets a 152-18, the public doesn't have anything to lose. If the person cleans up their act, they're successful, they do everything they're supposed to do, then they get a carrot. They're not walking around with a conviction on their record, and they're able to become employed and have housing and so on. And on the other hand, if they mess up, then they've pled guilty, they're guilty, the conviction is entered, they can be sentenced to whatever the appropriate sentence is under the existing law. So it's a matter of giving a few people who are low-level offenders a chance. There's been some discussion about what judges think of this idea of making it a presumption. All three judges on the task force voted to make it a presumption. You can see that in writing on page 71, where there's an appendix that's called the third proposal. That was the judge's proposal, and the three judges recommended that this should become a presumption. So I don't think that would be too hard for the court to manage a piece of law like that. And I just would ask you respectfully, what do we have to lose by giving this first-time low-level possession offender a chance to clean up their act? Secondly, something that we didn't do, we had a proposal to repeal Minnesota Statute 152.025, Subdivision 3B. That right now requires a six-month jail sentence, which is absolutely mandatory for any repeat offender. Now, in some cases, you might say that putting away repeat offenders is really a good thing. If you get a repeat offender in the area of robbery, after a while, you start to feel that this person is a robber. Or if you get a repeat offender in the area of burglary, pretty soon you're calling this person a burglar. But you can have a second-time, low-level drug offender who is an addict. And this existing law, 152.025 sub 3B, takes away the discretion from the judge to put this person in treatment or to fashion some other alternative. There's a case that came out in December that you've got copies of, State versus Linda Marie Cobb. And the county attorneys say that the Court of Appeals was wrong about this case. I just got an email yesterday about that. But the Court of Appeals says you've got to give them the 6 months. This is a woman that the court says was clean of drugs for 2.5 years. The court says, in light of the unnecessarily harsh result in this case, we urge the legislature to re-examine its approach. So I would just suggest you take a look at this. This is, obviously there's two sides to every story, but this is a situation where you could give the court the discretion not to be mandated to give that 6 months in jail. Finally, Madam Chair and members, I feel personally that the working group didn't really address the basic problem of the proportionality of the drug sentences in Minnesota. And so you've got a handout that has a chart of the sentencing guidelines grid on one side, and on the other side, it's got the BCA chart of what drugs sell for in Minnesota. You know, flipping these back and forth is very, very instructive. And I'd ask you, please, if you take a look at the sentencing guidelines grid, level 8, in the first box where there's zero criminal history score, it's right above the black oblong here. You'll see on the left of the grid, people who are in that box at level 8 get 48 months. Okay? Well, right now, here's the law about selling cocaine in Minnesota. If you sell 3 grams, you're in that box and you get 48 months as a first offender. Now, 3 grams is enough for a user to use in 2 days. And if you flip over to the BCA price chart and you see what a gram is worth $105. So you're taking an individual who's selling 3 grams of a drug for $315, and you're giving them a sentence of 4 years in prison. They're in the same box as an armed robber. They're in the same box as a person who commits first-degree arson, which is burning down a house with people in it. Okay, so it's pretty... I don't know how you all feel about that. Of course, I'm a public defender. I've worked with these people for years. I have some empathy for these folks, and I'm sure many of you do, too. It doesn't seem to me that selling $315 worth of cocaine is the same level of crime as burning down houses. And I just would ask you if you would think about that. And I think the recommendation to move that number to 5 grams is an improvement, but it's a kind of a small improvement, because that 5 grams is enough to keep a user happy for 2 to 3 days. And again, the value of that would be $525. So now you've got somebody that's made a $525 drug sale, doing 4 years in prison at a cost to the state of $25,000 a year. They're taking up one of those beds. I would respectfully say I don't believe it's proportional. If you look up one box to 86 months, that's for folks that sell 10 grams. 10 grams is enough to keep a user using for less than a week. But that person gets 7 years in prison, the same as somebody who commits manslaughter in the first degree. And again, I've had manslaughter cases, I've had drug cases, I have to say there's no comparison. And so, Madam Chair and members, I feel that although it was a very interesting and collegial and intense experience being on this working group, I don't feel that we adequately addressed proportionality. And as a result, the recommendations are such that if you do everything that the work group recommended, you'll save 97 beds in a system that is growing by 200 beds a year. So you're saving less than half of the growth of the beds if you do this. So I'm here to suggest that perhaps it would benefit from more discussion of alternatives that might have more of an impact.
Questions? Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Stuart, if we did make a change and made 152.025 permissive as opposed to mandatory, that we wouldn't see any state bed savings, would we? Because it's a 6 month commit, so that they're going to the county jail in that instance, aren't they?
Mr. Stewart.
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, I believe the statute says either 6 months in jail or execute the sentence to the commissioner. So it would be a savings to local government at least, and it might be a savings to the state, and it might be an opportunity for the individual to go to treatment and get straightened out instead of being behind bars.
How about Representative
Black? Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stewart, I apologize. I came in late here, but I just heard the tail end of your comments, and it made me think of a question for you. Do you know how many years in prison Al Capone got when he was convicted?
Mr. Stewart.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I think it's a trick question because he died in prison. He had syphilis, and he never got out of prison at all. So he essentially had a life sentence, as it turned out, on tax crimes. He had failed to pay, I don't know, taxes on beer or some such.
Yeah. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Stewart. You anticipated my next question, if you think he got that many years in prison for being a tax cheat.
Mr. Stewart.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I think that Al Capone was a very dangerous individual in terms of public safety, and I would support giving Al Capone a long, long time in prison. I would respectfully say, though, that these folks that have got 3 grams of cocaine in their pocket are not Al Capone.
Okay, thanks. And Madam Chair, if I could just for the purposes of comment, it is true, members of the committee, I understand when we talk about decriminalizing these things, there's a tendency to say these are non-violent drug offenses, and they're not. drugs are heavily, heavily linked to violence, and I think we need to be careful about when we talk about modifying these things. That was my only point. Thank you, Mr. Stewart.
Representative Drakowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stewart, to what degree did the work group talk about drug court and it as an alternative for some of these lower level offenses?
Mr. Stewart.
Madam Chair, Representative, that wasn't one of our mandates, but inside conversations, generally people felt that the drug courts were a very positive development. I've been on three of the committees that have been working on drug courts, and they are showing lower levels of recidivism than the standard method of just putting people through the prison system. So, you know, I think most of the people in the working group supported drug courts, but drug courts are very labor-intensive, the staff costs are high, and then in the long run, they save money for the state, but it's up front, you need some money to get them going, which is why we only have about 25 operating drug courts in the state now.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to kind of make another comment, too, and that is that, you know, I appreciate the comments about proportionality here and also Representative Lesh's comment about, you know, what drug crimes really are and what they lead to. But I just really want to kind of frame this for members to remember that we're dealing this year with an enormous budget deficit. And so when we're talking about these things, it's not just, you know, what are we really making choices between? I guess that's really my point here, that, you know, when it's costing $25,000 a year to keep somebody in prison, you know, we're not just choosing between, you know, we're not doing this in a vacuum. We're not saying, you know, let's spend this money and put people in prison. We're making choices between all the things that the state funds, really. You know, we're making choices between funding health care and funding prisons. We're making choices between funding schools and funding prisons. And so, you know, even if some of us don't think that it's ideal to have less time for certain offenses, I think we need to remember that what we're doing this session is making choices between things that are not ideal. We're making bad choices. And so I think it's important to keep that in mind, that, you know, maybe we'd like to be able to, some of us, not me, would like to be able to put people away for a long, 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 long time for selling a small amount of cocaine, but the question is, you know, how does that stack up against using the money for other very important purposes? I guess what I'd like to ask Mr. Stewart is, you know, whether you know of any evidence in terms of the efficacy of putting somebody in prison for some of these crimes. Is it, I mean, we all know that we have multiple reasons we put people in prison. One is just to immobilize and get them off the street. Another is to, you know, let people who might be thinking about committing that crime think again. And another is to actually reform them in some way. And I'm wondering whether you have any data or know of any data about how well any of this reforms any of these people who are committing these crimes.
Mr. Stewart.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, roughly speaking, the Department of Corrections says that over 80% of the people in prison are either chemically dependent or abusing chemicals. And about 35% of the people in prison are able to get treatment in prison. And when folks leave prison, two-thirds of them recidivate within 3 years. So, I'm not an expert on criminology, but it seems to me that this system isn't working perfectly, okay? It's not even working real well, I would say. The drug courts are a lot better in terms of recidivism and in terms of, you know, getting people working and functioning and sober for long periods of time.
Thank you. Further questions from members? Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, it's not exactly a question. You said, Mr. Stewart, you said everything's just hunky-dory if we allow them out and no bad things if we don't have them, if we have this deferral program or diversion. What my neighborhoods, and as you, I don't know if you know, but my district, unfortunately, has now become the capital for the drug offenses and for the most shootings. Unfortunately, it used to be represented Champions District, which is close second, I believe. What the police, these victims, the people that actually live in these neighborhoods where it's often people from the two suburbs to the north of me that are selling in my district, and they're having a lot of problems of their own right now. And what the cops and others, the victims, are saying is if you give them these diversion programs, in many cases they just go out and commit a lot more crimes before you can catch them again for something and actually convict them of something else. So it's easy to say that, but the people that are sitting there and having to deal with this, you don't live there in the Jordan neighborhood all of your life. And I remember judges, and I invited about 15 judges to come up there and even walk and meet neighbors, and only one, Peter Albrecht, was willing to go up there of the 15 I offered. And we are, you know, talking about saving money. If we save $2 million out of $8 billion or whatever it's going to be, isn't a large amount, since we're already the second lowest in both cost per capita and number of people per capita in the country. I think Maine is the lowest on both those issues. So I don't know that I disagree with you on the issue of the mandatory one, but I think there's another side to what you're presenting. And I would just like to say, since he's still in the audience, I heard from a number of law enforcement that thanked County Attorney Freeman for a strong position on this report. I'm not going too far the other way.
All right. Thank you, Representative Mullery. Further questions from members on the committee? Seeing none, Mr. Stewart, did you have any final comment?
Madam Chair, I'd like to address Representative Mullery for a minute and say, I lived in Whittier for 12 years. I lived in the inner city in Philadelphia for 10 years. I'm aware that drugs do a lot of harm in neighborhoods, and I'm not here to simply say, please let all these folks go. I just think that by crafting some alternatives that combine some sanctions and some rewards for good behavior, and some use of prison, and some use of treatment, and some use of jail, you could be doing better than what we're doing now, and save a lot of resources. So I'm not saying to let them all go. I'm just saying that these guidelines are not evidence-based. Nobody looked at recidivism when they were putting these guidelines together. So we just kind of have what we have, and it's, of course, up to you to decide if it's working or not.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart.
Thank you.
All right, next we have Mr. Hunter from Lake Calhoun Executive Center. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Brock Hunter. I'm actually the legislative chair for the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, Lake Calhoun Executive Center, just happens to be where I office. First, I wanted to thank the commission, the committee, and I want to indicate that my participation in this working group has been an honor. I think this is a vitally important issue to the state, and I am grateful to have had an opportunity in taking part in this discussion. Kind of picking up where Mr. Stewart left off, I want to make it clear that Mr. Stewart and I and other members of the defense community agree that there are dangerous people in this state who need to be in prison to protect public safety. No question about it. Our concern lies in the fact that the thresholds for drugs in Minnesota right now are so artificially low because of the Russell decision back in 1991 and the actions taken to lower thresholds immediately thereafter, that for approximately 20 years now, we've been sending away a lot of people who would have otherwise been considered fairly low-level drug offenders away as if they were kingpins. We've got judges across the state departing from the presumptive guideline sentence in over 60% of cases. Because they look at the presumptive sentence, they look at the offender and say, this just doesn't match up. What we're hoping to do is take a smarter approach to try to identify those people that truly are dangerous and send them to prison and take those people who are potentially redeemable and treatable and avoid sending them off to prison where, quite frankly, they could come back worse off and a greater threat to public safety than when we sent them. Prison is a tough place. Gang activity in prison is extremely prevalent, and a lot of people who weren't necessarily involved in that when they were sent to prison get involved while in prison because they want to survive. They network with other offenders in prison, and when they come out, a lot of times they're a lot more sophisticated a criminal than when they went off to prison in the first place. We're taking an apple that might be just starting to go bad and throwing it into a barrel of bad apples, and guess what you get back? Time after time, I have clients who went off to prison for a relatively low-level offense, and when they come back and I run into them again after they've recidivated, they're covered in prison tattoos. They're a different person than the first person that I saw go off to prison. And that really needs to change, because I think in many cases we're counterproductive. We're sending the wrong people off, and they're coming back much, much greater threat to public safety. Now, I would ask you to look at a chart that's in your packet that we provided that shows Minnesota's thresholds and sentencing procedures as compared to other states. This is a set of charts that comes from the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission's report from this last January. And I'm not going to go through it number by line by line, but you can see that Minnesota is significantly out of step with other states in our area, states with very strong reputations for being extremely tough on crime, like Texas. We're much tougher than them on drugs, and even the federal court system, which I think shows that we have some room to improve and raise those thresholds without being out of step with other states, without standing out from the crowd. We stand out from the crowd right now. I also want to just briefly touch upon the threshold issue in general. And I would call your attention back to page 8 in the report that summarizes the threshold proposals that were competing during the course of the working group. And you can see that they're divided out between the present thresholds in the second column, and then law enforcement, defense. The third proposal, which in fact was actually the judge's proposal, it was put forward by three judges and a Washington County probation officer, there was a compromise proposal. And then the final working group proposal that was passed by a narrow majority. You'll see here that law enforcement came in and proposed very minor increases in hard drug thresholds from 25 to 35 grams for first-degree level offense. No changes at all in sales. Pretty substantial reductions in marijuana thresholds, which is on the charts on the page before. The defense, Mr. Stewart and I, responded by making a counterproposal to raise thresholds fairly significantly. From possession for first degree would go from 25 grams up to 250 grams, which admittedly is a lot. But I would point out that 250 grams is still half of the original first degree threshold prior to the Russell decision. Originally, the legislature set threshold for first degree possession of a hard drug was 500 grams, nearly a pound. That was considered at the time by experts to be approximately the amount of drugs that a true kingpin, a drug wholesaler, would have on hand at any given time, and that wholesaler would sell in approximately 50-gram increments. These are the people at the top of the drug pyramid who are, we would agree, posing a threat to public safety comparable to first-degree arson and manslaughter, etc. The thresholds that we proposed were actually borrowed from a bill that was introduced back in 2004 by Representatives Whitman and Ellison that unfortunately didn't get very far, but we thought that those thresholds were workable. And then we added aggravating factors. We said that if you're going to go by weight alone, then you've got to have a lot of weight to say somebody's a real kingpin. But if you can show that they have two or more factors, such as the use of a gun during the offense, such as employment of children in the drug distribution hierarchies, a pattern of sale offenses, and there were several others that you can read in the report, but then you could use the existing thresholds, the 10 and 25 gram thresholds. If you've got two aggravating factors, then you can use the existing thresholds. Otherwise, you need to catch them with more drugs if that's all you've got in order to identify them as a more dangerous public safety threat. I would note that the original law enforcement proposal went down on an 8-8 tie vote. The defense proposal failed on an 8-8 tie vote, with law enforcement and some community group members on one side, with the defense judges, corrections officer, and treatment personnel on the other. And then at the next meeting, the judges and the corrections officer came forward with the third proposal, as you see in this table, that really was a compromise proposal. It had a fairly substantial increase in thresholds with essentially the same aggravating factors the defense had used, and presumptive use of 15218, getting rid of the 6 month mandatory minimum, and some other things Mr. Stewart talked about. The defense immediately signed on to that. We thought that was a good workable compromise. It wasn't everything that we wanted, but we thought that it was moving towards some kind of compromise. And we were disappointed, frankly, when law enforcement didn't go for it. It went down also on an 8-8 vote. Eventually, what happened is there was a minor modification to the law enforcement proposal, and the corrections officer, the probation officer, changed his vote over to the final report. So we just want to make sure that it's emphasized that this was a very close decision, that there were people involved in the system, not just defense attorneys, but judges, treatment professionals, probation officers, that really wanted to see a more substantial change than what came out of the final recommendation. I would just note that drug offenders going off to prison have declined in the past few years, and I on this issue, I agree with Mr. Freeman completely as to why. We put pseudoephedrine behind the counter in pharmacies, making it much more difficult to manufacture methamphetamine here in Minnesota. And there has been a pretty, I think, good education effort going on. What Mr. Freeman did not say is that the reason that the drug problems are going down is because of the aggressive law enforcement and prison sentences that we've been using for the last 20 years. It hasn't had any impact. In fact, drug usage and drug sentences, people going off to prison, has pretty much increased steadily over the last 20 years. And yes, Representative Mullery, there are neighborhoods like yours and others, like I live in Minneapolis, that are suffering greatly. I would just point out that if the status quo worked, our neighborhoods would be improving. But instead, they're going in the opposite direction. And I would submit that's because we have generations now of people who have been sent off to prison and are coming back much more sophisticated criminals, much less able to get a productive job in our society because of their record, and who are recidivating and are doing it in a much more sophisticated level than they otherwise would have. There's got to be a way to break the cycle and do something differently, and we hope that there's still a chance to do that. And with that, I'll open the questions.
Representative Corner.
I'll pass.
All right, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in my county, I've had some discussions with some of the folks working in the justice area, and one of the things that was mentioned is about these minimum mandatory sentences that they, and I think it was the county attorney, in fact, who mentioned this, that it makes it much more difficult to resolve the cases by plea, and therefore it has a lot of downstream effects of kind of backing up people in the jail, backing up the courts. I mean, we all know that right now the court system altogether is really having a lot of difficulty just because of the budget restrictions. I've had judges saying to me, just tell me what you don't want us to do, because we just can't keep doing everything we're doing. So this issue about backing things up in the system, it's a little bit different than what we're mainly talking about here, the sentencing, but I wonder if you could comment on that. Has that been your experience, that there's that downstream effect that most people wouldn't really even think about unless you work in the court?
Mr. Hunter.
Madam Chair, Representative Levin, I couldn't agree more. Mandatory minimums sound good on paper, but in reality, I think it does complicate the situation in the court system, because the judge is not able, in those instances, to do a downward departure. Is forced to send somebody off for a prescribed amount of time when in an individual case it may not make sense. And so you do have people litigating their cases and stringing them out in the court system and fighting on the hopes that somehow they'll get an acquittal,
when they probably would have been willing to resolve their case in some kind of plea negotiated settlement were it not for that mandatory minimum sentence.
Thank you. Questions from members? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Hunter. Next, we have David Crist, Minnesota Department of Corrections. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, my name is David Crist. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Corrections. Before I get into my presentation here, I feel compelled to address a couple of impressions that my friend John Stewart might have left the committee with. First, we have no plans to build a new prison every 4 years in Minnesota. In fact, there is no new prison on the drawing board in Minnesota. We anticipate, if all things stay the same as they are right now, we would anticipate asking the legislature to bond for a 400-bed unit at Faribault in 2014, which we would occupy in 2017. That's on the male side, and we have no plans to increase female beds in Minnesota at all. The projections don't show, they go out 10 years, they don't show we're going to need any female beds. So I wanted to state that. And I also wanted to address recidivism for a moment. On a national scale, recidivism might be that two-thirds of offenders return to prison after 3 years, but in Minnesota, after 3 years, only one-third of offenders return to prison after 3 years in Minnesota. In fact, as the committee will hear later this week with our performance report, for completers of chemical dependency treatment in Minnesota, the recidivism rate after 3 years is something like 8 to 12%, and I'll talk about our challenge incarceration program here in a minute, where the recidivism rate for people that participated in that program, including chemical dependency treatment, is somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 to 8% after 3 years. So I just couldn't not say those things. The Department of Corrections has concerns with the expansion of the conditional release program, and we stand in opposition to that recommendation of the working group. The department's base budget was cut at the beginning of the conditional release program by about $1,800,000, but we've only realized $250,000 in bed savings as a result of that program. Few offenders committed to Minnesota prisons are low risk or nonviolent. The committee heard a presentation by Dr. Grant Dewey a couple of weeks ago where he explored the complexity of the prior offenses that our offenders have. Minnesota has the second lowest per capita incarceration rates in the country. We've got probably the highest use of probation and intermediary sanctions out there in the community before people get to prison, and we've got one of the lowest uses of minimum security of any corrections department in the country. And for what that adds up to is that we've got dangerous people in prison.
Mr. Crist, if I might, half of this committee did not hear the presentation that you gave about the demographics of the crimes of people in prison. So if you actually could submit a copy of that slideshow to Representative Paymar's Public Policy or Public Finance Committee, that would probably be helpful to the members.
Madam Chair, gladly.
Thank you, Mr. Crist.
Yes.
Please continue.
So I would submit that the people that come to prison in Minnesota are a danger to the public, and that it's difficult to make decisions about who in that group should be released early. We've had many opportunities for treatment and other sanctions prior to being sent to prison, and offenders who do not qualify for the conditional release program, it's because they've got because of their current offense, because of their many prior offenses, and because many of them have histories of violence. We're concerned that if one of these offenders in an early release program does get out early and subsequently reel fens in a violent way that would jeopardize all of our early release programs in the department, including the challenge incarceration program that I'll talk about as an alternative here. I think it was Mr. Stewart who did say that 80% of our offenders, 83% of offenders who come to prison in Minnesota are assessed as needing treatment. Only 34% of them can be admitted to treatment programs. And the DOC hasn't been funded to provide chemical dependency treatment to all of the offenders who've been assessed as needing it. The department has operated a highly successful challenge incarceration program, or the boot camp, for about 16 years. The camp provides a good measure of military discipline, physical training, but also education and intensive chemical dependency treatment. The outcomes have been evaluated there. The results show that participation in the challenge incarceration program reduces chances of re-imprisonment for a new crime by 35% as compared to a control group. And the recidivism rates for reconviction of any felony is 8.8% after 3 years, and for reincarceration, a subset of the reconvictions, is 4.4%. The DOC has empty beds in that program. We would like to see people filling those beds. And I would note that the two programs, CIP and CRP, draw from the same candidate pool. So in effect, they compete with one another. We would rather have one program that isn't competing with another program within our own department for those beds. And finally, I want to address the recommendation for funding out of bed space savings as a result of in expansion of the conditional release program. That recommendation is based on the assumption that the Department of Corrections is funded for bed space up front, when in fact our early release programs are taken into account in our bed space projections, and the Department of Finance funds us at that level. So we really aren't getting any upfront money for early release programs, and thus there isn't any intangible savings dollars that we could say, okay, here we're going to take those savings this year right now and increase our chemical dependency treatment and corrections and have a pot of money to hand into the community for increased treatment over there. The funding mechanism just doesn't work that way. So, Madam Chair, I stand for questions.
Questions from members. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, when such a low percentage of the people in prison are getting treated, and I understand that the system wants to put them in special units and special beds set aside and so on, but what about programs like AA? I mean, isn't that available to people just in the general population? I mean, that seems like it wouldn't be very expensive, and do people have that available even if they're not formally in treatment?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, absolutely. We don't count that program as a primary clinical chemical dependency program, so we don't try to take advantage of that in our recidivism studies. We count the programs where we're doing primary clinical chemical dependency treatment, but we've got Alcoholics Anonymous groups that meet in all of our facilities. We've got Narcotics Anonymous in all of our facilities. They're very active. We've got very active aftercare programs following the intensive primary treatment in all of our facilities as well.
Further questions? Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. I'm just curious as to what you're opposed with. If the working group recommended just the increase in early prison release, says after they completed treatment in prison, is it a specific treatment you're after, or
because the work group said after they completed treatment.
Mr. Chris.
Madam Chair, Representative Kelly, what the department wants is to be able to focus our early release program on the challenge incarceration program. The conditional release program relies on the department to predict who might be successful in a treatment program, admit them to the program based on the fact that we don't think that they are public safety risk, and then release them early from their incarceration based on that prediction. That's very imprecise. We worry about being wrong. We worry about sending somebody into the community who is going to turn out to be a public safety risk and cause more harm.
Chair.
Representative Kelly.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So that recidivism rate that we're talking about at 8.8%, is that just through that program or is it through other treatment programs?
Mr. Chris.
Madam Chair, Representative Kelly, that is the recidivism rate through the challenge incarceration program, the boot camp program that's operated at our Willow River facility. The conditional release program participants go through the medium security triad program at the Lionel Lakes prison.
Thank you.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Now, when you talk about the challenge, Mr. Chris, when you talk about the challenge incarceration program, is there space available in that program? And if so, how could we get some of these prisoners that need CD treatment into it on a better ratio?
Mr. Chris.
Madam Chair, Representative Olin, there is space available in that program. We have been working with the department's criteria for admission to that program in order to get more people into the program without creating a risk to the public of adding inappropriate offenders into that program.
Further questions from members? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Chris.
Thank
members,
you.
I need a motion to approve the minutes. The motion is moved by Representative Reinhart. Oh, you're on the wrong committee. This is for the Public Safety Policy Oversight Committee. Representative West moved the minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, I just want to make the announcement that at the next hearing, we are going to be looking at the performance report of the Department of Corrections. We also just got the budget from the governor, and so the policy about goals and performance for the Department of Corrections, and then the results page from the Internet as well. So just to let you know, that's what we'll be talking about. And if you look at the agenda, I have referred some of the bills to Representative West's Crime Victims Criminal Records Division by memo, and those are listed on the agenda. With no further issues, this meeting is adjourned.
Yeah, I'm not going to record.